And for my new film, From Here to Andromeda, you know, getting near the end, it's a four-part, you know, a four-hour series, 1 hour per part. It comes out this month at the end of the month, and the link is up on your site there. But the thing that I found is at the very end I got an interview, kind of the interview of the century, with a 20-year veteran, senior research scientist, top secret clearance, Lockheed Martin for 20 years, a man named Boyd Bushman, who worked on advanced aircraft concepts, and he worked for Texas Instruments from 79 to 87. He worked for Parsons International of Iran. He worked for Hughes Aircraft from the early 60s to the late mid-70s. And he's got over 26 patents on file, and he actually is one of the main designers behind the Stinger missile, which used to be called Red Eye. And he disclosed virtually everything about UFOs, anti-gravity, reverse-engineered craft in this, you know, candid interview that we just got for the new film. And he really confirms a lot of what, you know, you, John, were saying to me, that, yeah, there are ET craft here, but they're very rare. And we have reverse-engineered a lot of this technology. And he actually demonstrates anti-gravity right in front of me, step by step through these, you know, these series of very simple experiments. And then he starts scaling it up and showing me diagrams and paperwork that show some of the classified aircraft that they've been working on for years now.
And do you think that they gave him permission to do that?
I think he has permission. And, in fact, one of the reasons I think he has permission is because they know, I mean, when I say they, I mean literally all of the, you know, the highest level scientists know that there's a very slim chance that all of us are going to make it, you know, through these great earth changes that are consequential to global warming, sewage pollution, and, you know, ozone depletion. I mean, there's a lot of compounding problems to the ecology. And I don't think that they believe that a lot of us are going to make it unless we have a major shift in energy technology. And they've had, I mean, Boyd Bushman showed me a diagram of this, you know, 30-foot-wide flying saucer, 40-foot-wide saucer that was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1960, and the contractor on the sheet of paper was Boeing Convair. It was nuclear-powered, and it flew 3,000 miles, 62,000 feet. But what's interesting about it is he testifies that he knows the engineer who put it together. I mean, so he's personalizing it. And when he shows me how anti-gravity really works, you know, on a small scale, and how they amplified that using nuclear-powered generators, it all just, you know, came flying together and made a lot of sense. And even Senator Barry Goldwater, you know, tried to get access to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base because that is where allegedly the Roswell craft was being stored and where they were reverse engineering it. And, you know, he was denied access by Curtis LeMay and General Twining. I mean, these guys had locked up Roswell so deep that politicians couldn't even get in there. And so why now? Why is there a disclosure now? And the reason I believe is when you consider the bell curve, you know, that technology that's being developed in the military for decades, when it finally gets to the point that they're way ahead of that, they start releasing technology that we can, you know, partake of and use to better our world. And the thing about anti-gravity that strikes me the most for motor vehicles and the way we use energy, you know, we transport goods in cargo containers and our motor vehicles. If you can cancel even 50% of the gravity on a motor vehicle, you can increase its fuel efficiency by at least that. And that means we use, you know, 50% less fuel. And the way it actually works, the way he demonstrated right in front of me the way it works is, on a simple level, he takes two $5,000 super neodym magnets. And you know what happens when you take magnets and you put them north-north or south-south?
Yeah.
They repel each other, right? Well, he drills a hole in the center of these, and these are really expensive magnets, and he bolts them down so he forces them together, which causes a six-foot diameter field to envelop around the magnets. He actually measures it. He wraps it in plaster to make it look like a rock, and he gets another rock that looks the same but doesn't have magnets inside of it. And he goes up to his version of, you know, Galileo's Leaning Tower of Pisa, which is a 59-foot tower at Lockheed Martin. And he drops them off the tower nine times in a row. And he has these guys standing at the bottom who have no education in anything, you know, in the world of science or physics. And he tells them to hand him the one that hits the ground first, because he knows that one of them is actually going to go slower. And he violates, you know, Galileo Newtonian physics and finds that the one with the opposing magnets falls considerably slower or much noticeably slower than the other one. So what he's demonstrated is that Galileo's law, for those who don't understand, and Newton, is that if you drop a feather on the moon or a hammer, which was done in Apollo 15, it, regardless of the weight of two objects, they both fall at the same rate of speed, you know, towards the Earth or towards gravity.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, he canceled out a percentage of gravity, which is remarkable, because if you can even cancel out 10% of the gravity on a motor vehicle or an airplane or the space shuttle, any kind of aircraft, you know what that means, John. I mean, that's enormous.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm starting to interrupt your train of thought, but
no.
I read back several years ago that when they had been working on anti-gravity using magnets, that they found that it had a severe effect on human bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they stop that whole thing because of did he mention that?
No, he didn't talk. I mean, Nikola Tesla worked around strong magnetic and electromagnetic fields, and he lived to be 87 years old and, you know, no cancer. There are certain levels of magnetism that are beneficial to the human body, and there are certain configurations that are harmful. So I think it's just a matter of how you configure some of these fields for the human body. But what he does next is he holds up this diagram of a nuclear-scale version of two opposing field nuclear-powered magnets. And it's this huge contraption, and it's being lowered by a crane into a classified aircraft. And he shows me pictures of this thing. And when I zoom in on the corner, I see Convair, you know, which was a major defense contractor back then, and you know, that's obviously who was testing these things. So when I think of what, you know, John Lear told me in person, that a lot of these craft are ours, I mean, it's just starting to come together. I'm looking at the dates on this and, you know, thinking, oh my God, I mean, what if the craft I saw in Berkeley in 1968 was one of ours? You know, it was a metallic saucer hovering not far from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. But then he goes on to talk about Roswell, and a friend of his is a Navy doctor who back in 1947 was treating a young pilot who had just shot down the Roswell craft. And the pilot has some kind of radiation burns, so he's being treated by this doctor, and he proceeds to tell the doctor the story that, you know, this is post-World War II. We see what appears to be an aircraft in our skies that's not friendly because it's not communicating with us. And this pilot said it was spherical and glowing and was traveling faster than the fastest aircraft we had. So he was trailing just behind it. And they gave him the order to, you know, saying, you have the weapon on board. Go ahead and shoot this thing down. So I said, I mean, and so he shot it down. And I said to Boyd Bushman, well, what kind of a weapon could it have been? Because this was 1947, and there's no way bullets could take down, you know, a flying saucer with a strong energy field around it. And he just laughed, and he said, we have all kinds of things out there. Well, just recently, the FBI, under their FOIA, on their website, on the FBI's website, I found 1,500 pages of recently declassified UFO files. And in there, I found about 120 pages on Nikola Tesla, the late great electrical engineer. And in 1943, Tesla died on January the 7th and the 8th, 1943, at the Hotel New Yorker. There's this huge search for all of his patents and experiments on the Tesla death ray. And the death ray was being developed by Tesla, you know, before he died. And there are reports in these FBI files that there's a United Airlines pilot over San Francisco. I believe it's a United plane. That the pilot actually calls in and he feels this electrostatic charge coming into his aircraft and literally just zapping the entire plane, and then the plane falls out of the sky and falls into the San Francisco Bay. And they didn't know what it was, and some people thought, you know, I guess the FBI was trying to lead into, you know, could this have been the Tesla death ray being tested? And so that's what the death ray does. It electrostatically, you know, zaps all the circuits, the spark plugs, the wiring, even the metal itself in the aircraft, and takes it down. And this was in 1943, so of course in 1947 they would have had, I'm sure, a very good working prototype, and that would be what I estimate this pilot actually took down the Roswell craft with. But then, of course, the craft is taken. Boyd Bushman says the pilot, when he lands, they find three of the aliens, and the other one is running around somewhere on his own. They can't find him. And he goes in to describe this without actually physically describing the aliens. He said the walls of the saucer were translucent, that you could see through them, which is really amazing, and that obviously it was taken eventually to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And scientists are the ones who had access to it because they're the ones that, you know, they could try to understand how these things work.
Hey, John, does any of this sound familiar to you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So that's you know, one of, you know, 20 interviews I got for the new film that I'm just releasing, From Here to Andromeda. And he goes on to, you know, do these very, very interesting experiments in front of me, and I'm trying to merge my ideas in anti-gravity with his, and it turns out I'm extremely close to where they are. And I may have not certified yet, solved part of the problem they're having. And that is because it takes so much energy in the opposing fields to produce an anti-gravity effect, which is, he actually says that it's not the same as producing a lot of mass energy, because mass and energy and gravity are in this, you know, very close relationship formula, that gravity is proportional to mass. He said that's not what we're talking about at all. He said we're talking about a force entering, canceling out the forces of inertia. And inertia, for example, is both the energy of a body in motion and the tendency of that body to resist acceleration because of forces being applied to it. And then, of course, you have, you know, gravity and all these forces you're fighting. So if you can cancel out inertia and gravity, he's saying what actually happens is you start to enter what he calls the next force. There are four or five known forces that we know of. Most people think there are four, but he says four or five because we actually make a distinction between gravity and magnetism and electromagnetism. And so that gives us five forces. And he said they've now discovered the sixth force is the anti-gravity force, which he equates to the expansion force in the universe, the force that is impelling the galaxies apart. It's actually a force that is stronger than gravity, the counter to that, which is the pull. And beyond the sixth force is the seventh, eighth, and ninth. And those forces, are classified in our actual, you know, research labs. But they exist. These are forces that are far beyond any of the work of, you know, people like Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene and string theory. I mean, this is stuff that is so exotic, but it's not on paper. They're actually doing experiments with this. So, and then I started asking him, you know, near the end of my journey, which is, you know, from here to Andromeda, could one of these higher forces take us to the Andromeda galaxy? And he was affirmative, absolutely, that they could in a very small amount of time. And so that's kind of a general overview of that interview and where it goes.
John, I seem to recall you talking about similar subjects on regarding anti-gravity technology and how long we've had it. Would you share that, please, with the...
How long we've had it?
Yeah.
Well, since I'm sure the middle 50s, my dad worked on it with a number of other companies, and there's a videotape floating around on the Internet of him giving a lecture at the Bonson Institute, and he's standing at the blackboard, and he's drawn a saucer shape on there, and he's making some markings on it. And it's a very interesting tape. It doesn't have any sound, but it has a few minutes of engineers working with it appears to be balsa wood and tissue models. And one of the interesting things in this videotape is there's a calendar, and the calendar is they focus on this calendar every 20 or 30 seconds, and they're marking off dates like something is very important, some goal they're trying to reach. So yes, I would say that we certainly had anti-gravity perfected by 1959 or 1960. We certainly were going to the moon in our own craft in 1962. We were going to Mars in our own craft in 1966. So, you know, here we are 40 years later. We've certainly been a lot of other places.
And how does that jive with your information, David?
Well, you know, it just seems so ironic that, and, you know, I can confirm that I saw a flying saucer in 1968 in the Bay Area, silent, hovering with, you know, dozens of other witnesses just in the local area, very close to the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. So there's no question that the timing on what Boyd Bushman is releasing and what John is saying is accurate. But to go to the moon doesn't surprise me at all. Well, the only thing that surprises me is why we would create this organization called NASA and give this whole, you know, smokescreen space program to the American public and give them a very limited view of, you know, of physics.
NASA was the cover-up.
A cover-up. And so the question is, you know, even the story, Beth, you told me earlier today, which I don't know if we can talk about on the radio, but these giant black triangles that are being seen everywhere, the idea that you know, somebody has a wife and kids or maybe not and goes to work every day and flies these things and is, you know, has, you know, queer interaction with extraterrestrials, and they do it, and, you know, who knows? Who knows these people? Who knows the pilots of these aircraft? I mean, these guys have done such a good job at keeping this stuff covered up that, you know, it's taken until now to have some kind of disclosure. And I think what's going to happen is the anti-gravity part of it will trickle down to, you know, here's an example. Most of the energy we use in a motor vehicle is to turn a heavy crankshaft in the center of our vehicle to turn the four tires, which are ripping themselves against concrete and pavement and gravity and the forces of inertia. But once you get a car, say, levitating, you know, 1 foot off the ground, and instead of spending all of that energy fighting, you know, the forces, you're actually spending a certain amount of energy transforming the forces so that you can enter this sixth force that's free of inertia and gravity. How much energy does it take to go 80 miles an hour? Nothing. I mean, tiny little ion thrusters, you know, you can have them just like attitude thrusters, John, on an aircraft, stationed all over the sides of this thing. And when you want to brake, you just reverse thrust. And when you want to, you know, nudge left and right, you just have these little ion thrusters that can be run on solar panels. I mean, they don't need a lot of energy to get going really fast.
Well, I was just thinking of your question about why would they create a false front. If this is actually true, the potentiality for making two completely different sectors of society, people who know and have everything and everybody else, you know, I mean, if this were actually as the Ron Schmidt and John and myself, and we've done a lot of research into this effort, we're actually on the right track. The guys who started this were basically Nazi scientists. Now they may have reformed, but if they started NASA and they were Nazis, their whole premise of the Nazi ideal was that there's a super race, and then there's everybody else.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, the Aryan race, and that they're the only ones who have access, you know, to this higher level of civilization.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, I'm not saying that. I don't know personally. I can't prove this, and I don't want to try people and judge them unfairly. But there are pieces of information out there that suggest this.